out the wrong window into the wrong day. I'll give you back my make-believe if you give me back my way. Hey, Mr. Dreammaker, have you a dream to spare? Something so lovely, good enough to share. Sky once, but there was nothing there to knock on. Hey, Mr. Dreammaker, do I cash this in? You say I'm not hungry enough, your child, from sweet suffering. I've been walking on down the wrong side. Nobody there now I'd want to meet. Hey, Mr. Dreammaker, do you socialize? You got something to comfort these weary eyes? I've been looking out the wrong window. I've been looking at the world all alone. Now if I've seen something gruesome, you might say, dream comes true. Can I still go on dreaming the way you do? Hey, Mr. Dreammaker, but what if my dream comes true? Can I please go on dreaming the way you
from his dream, singing string beneath his hand.
And that was Heart, Nancy and Annie Wilson, when they were still doing sort of sword and sorcery songs instead of heavy metal like they are today. That was called Dream of the Archer, and that's sort of by way of promoting next Saturday morning, or maybe not next Saturday, but some Saturday in the future on Hour of the Wolf, Jim Freund's show, 5 to 7 a.m. on Saturday mornings. He will be delving into the mythology and the legends of Robin Hood, inspired by the recent release of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, with Kevin Costner. I heard about that on his show yesterday morning. My name is Sharon Griffiths. You've been listening to Heresy, and what you've been listening to for the majority of the time since 5 a.m., was Dialogue with the Dream Self, An Anatomy of Dreams, which is chapter 3 in a book called The Anatomy of Freedom by Robin Morgan. And Miracle of Miracles, well, let me tell you what I played before Death of the Archer by Heart. I played Mr. Dreammaker by Jane Biella, Dream Child by Chris Williamson, and I'm Dreaming by Jennifer Warnes. I found no fewer than 11 songs that mention dreams, even in the title, when going through my women's music collection, so I had to play at least a few of them for you. I have time, Mirabelle Dictu, to read you a very short piece from Anaïs Nin's Under a Glass Bell, put out by Swallow. This is still available, by the way, at Judith's Room. I saw it there. I saw all of Anaïs Nin's work at Judith's Room, and I was thrilled. I even bought a little postcard with her picture on it because she's such a beautiful lady. Speaking of which, picture postcards sent to moi are appreciated. My name is Sharon Griffiths, and I'm at WBAI, 505 8th Avenue, New York 10018, on the 19th floor. I love and admire and covet and enjoy and get real thrillsies over picture postcards. If my listeners would send one to me, I would be greatly, greatly appreciated. If one card per listener, that's all I'm asking, 17 or 18 cents postage. Please, it's very well appreciated. And also, as far as station business is concerned, pay your pledge. That's it. Three words. This is called The Eye's Journey. It's by Anaïs Nin from her collection Under a Glass Bell. He worked on small canvases with a touch as light as a cobweb and coloring made of images. He lived there, at the bottom of the sea, but a bottom of the sea cluttered with objects from shipwrecks. Fishes passed through one-eyed towers, anchors and weeds grew out of hulls. All that could fall from a rag picker's bag lay heaving restlessly, buried by Hans in a shipwreck of broken moods, lost fragments of irretrievable words. The green which enveloped the broken objects was the green of mildew, and the browns which shrouded the sceneries was the brown of stagnation. Aware it was through the eye that he had passed to reach this other side of the world, he had always painted a small human eye in the corner, the secret door of his escape into the deep regions unknown to the surface of the eyes. He had traversed the eye as through a looking glass, into its roots, into before birth and after death, and there found these layers of light, waves of wrecked moods, cells of immobility and pain corroded by the rust of stagnation. A storm was perpetually suspended over this, a storm from no one knew where, so that the miracles of beauty stillborn in the water were constantly threatened by an impending lightning, near explosion. The small fixed eye in the corner of the painting was hypnotized with terror. A world about to vanish always, on the brink of absolute catastrophe. At first, when the day began, the passage through the eye was made smoothly, and Hans flowed out of his room and beyond his misery. His body was as still as if it had been anesthetized, and the eye alone carried him everywhere, swimming, sliding, dissolving, penetrating. But after a few hours, the colors died on his fingertips, and the eye in the corner of the painting became glazed, and then utterly blind. He never knew if it was his body awakening to the consuming hunger, or the coldness of the room which enshrouded him, or the gradual consciousness of the wall in front of his window, the wall of the Prison de la Santé, or the stains on his own four walls, or the limpness of his one suit hanging on a peg, the emptiness of his torn pockets, the dust on his panes, or the falsetto voice of the concierge. But the eye closed. It was then he sailed out shiftily and insecurely toward drink. In drink he might find again some of the lost warmth, the lost incandescence, the lost dilation. As soon as he drank, the sky melted and the clouds galloped, the dampness ceased to gnaw and become like some gentle shower, and the cramp in his stomach from lack of food dissolved. Warmth and color and dilation of the heart and bowels into an infinite world. It was his room that was growing tighter around him, growing smaller, smaller, emptier, and the solitude would strangle him. Now everything was open while the glass was full, but when the glass was empty and the bartender refused to fill it, then he fell into an abysm again. His legs weakened and his eyes blurred. He lost everything then. The world shrank again, and the solitude was deeper because now people were laughing at him. People were talking about him. The woman who took care of him at the hospital was telling everyone the most intimate, revolting details of his illness, and they were laughing at him. The policeman knew he had not paid his rent for a year and was waiting to arrest him. He could not walk directly home either. He must catch it obliquely, tangentially. The friend, the glass of wine, home, they would all escape from his grasp if he reached for them directly. And while he stood there, he knew there was someone searching his room and trying to steal his paintings. So in the end, he ran back to his room and insulted the concierge, and his eyes protruded in an inordinate anger. She swore no one had been in his room, but he knew. He knew that he merely had not had the time to carry away the best of the paintings, but that he would return and that he must sit there and wait for the thief. So he refused to go out for his meals. The concierge was anxious over him and occasionally brought him a plate of soup, but he would not take it because it was poisoned. Finally, two strange men came to call for Hans. Hans knew why they came. They were going to keep him hidden until the other could steal his paintings, and then they would let him go free. There was no defense against them. He was too weak to fight them. He asked permission to dress himself. He wondered whether he should go without shoes. He would rather save them for his return. They were so worn they would not last very long. What he most regretted was that now he would miss watching the big snake at the zoo. Every day he had been there at feeding time because the big snake was fed live mice. He liked to watch the terror of the mouse who knew what awaited it as soon as it was placed in the cage. Its fixed terror, its incapacity to run away as soon as the snake began to gaze upon it with its unblinking stare. The snake knew it would not struggle but wait transfixed with terror. So the snake lingered and delayed the moment of devouring the mouse, enjoying the certainty. The mouse could not move, but its little eyes made a thousand revolutions of terror, while the eyes of the snake remained round, unblinking. Hans felt he was the mouse, and watched his own fate every day, his own passivity. His own eyes bulged like those of a perpetually frightened man. Even his paintings on the small canvas he made with the certainty that they were to be devoured. He had moments when he felt he was running a race with a giant snake. The more paintings he could weave out of himself as a cocoon weaving silk spools, the more he could delay the final annihilation. Now, while the men waited, he hesitated in the middle of the room, and then he thought, "But suppose that I die? I can't be buried without shoes. I must put my shoes on. I may die. If they forbid me to paint, I will die." And he laced his shoes on carefully for his death. Hans was permitted to paint in the cell room, which was so much like the room he had been living in. But slowly from the drinking, his eyesight began to fail him. They operated on them and saved one. For the lost one, they gave him a glass eye. And now Hans knew that he was no longer the mouse, but the snake. He was the one who watched everything and who would begin to devour, because his eye was fixed on the world. He could no longer move back and forth through the eye. When he saw flames leaping all around him, he merely stared at the flames. He stared at the flames as they raged around him. When the fire was put out in the asylum, he had lost his glass eye. He was neither mouse nor snake any longer. Anais Nin, from Under a Glass Bell. A piece called The Eye's Journey. You've been listening to Heresy on WBAI 99.5 FM. My name is Sharon Griffiths, and I will be back next week. Same bat time, same bat station. Bat channel, I believe it was. For something that will not be a hard-hitting expose, snore-snore type of show, but it will be on violence against women. It will be poetry, the poetry of women who have experienced violence and how they've dealt with it, practical advice from a wonderful book, I can't remember the name right now, of how to deal with the violence, how from the fact that the psychological fact that it is not your fault to the practical aspect of how to tell whether or not an injury that has been inflicted on you is fatal and what to do about it and where to go for help. I've got a mass of material, probably won't get to it all, but then again, I never do. And that's for next week, Violence Against Women. Not a pretty show, but it's not a pretty subject. So until then, picture postcards, plain postcards if you have to. And if you would like a playlist of what I have played, both the prose and the music, you can ask me for it, and I will send it to you with a stamped, self-addressed envelope, because I'm organized enough to do that every week, to sit at my computer and put these things together, just from my own archives. I'd like to share them with you if you want, even though none of the books, well, almost none of the books, and certainly none of the records I play are available, but it's worth a shot, right? See you in 1 week. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Sunday morning's a special on WBAI. Tune in at 7 a.m. for Through the Opera Glass, 2.5 hours of the most adventurous opera show on radio. Then, at 9:30, hear of a Sunday morning, early music with literate, loving commentary from Chris Wendt. So, start the week right with Through the Opera Glass from 7 to 9:30 a.m., and Chris Wendt's Hear of a Sunday Morning from 9:30 to 11:30. Some of the best music in New York on listener-sponsored WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
The weather for today, Sunday the 16th, 1991, will be warm and clear. You've got your dial set to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. The time is 7 a.m. Through the Opera Glass is a weekly feature of this station. Today's host is Manya. And now, Through the Opera Glass with Manya.
Welcome to Through the Opera Glass, a weekly feature here on WBAI in New York. I'm Manya, your host this day, and it's my pleasure to bring you a piece that is loosely based, very loosely based, on Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's Henry Purcell's The Fairy Queen. We'll be hearing a recording done by a group called Les Arts Florissants, directed by William Christie. This was after a production done at Aix-en-Provence in July of 1989, and it's on the Harmonia Mundi label. I think the best way to explain exactly what Mr. Purcell and his cohorts did to Mr. Shakespeare's work is to read you a piece from the libretto that's written by John Buttrey. It goes like this. The Fairy Queen was given for the first time at the Queen's Theatre, Dorset Gardens, London, on May 2, 1692. Its text was based on an existing theatrical piece, Shakespeare's comedy A Midsummer Night's Dream. The Shakespearean play, very well known, was about a century old. Its text was now altered to conform with the taste of the day, with emphasis being placed upon the Fairy Queen. In particular, the work was abridged to allow the introduction of musical scenes. When the alterations were made, certain scenes were placed in a different order, whilst others were simply dropped altogether. Shakespeare wrote A Midsummer Night's Dream around 1595 to be presented at the time of a wedding. To tie the play in with the wedding, its plot was constructed around the nuptials of Theseus with Hippolyta, queen of the Amazons, which forms the theme at the base of the intrigue. As the Fairy Queen was no longer intended to form part of marriage celebrations in 1692, the anonymous author who adapted the text deleted all reference to the nuptials of Theseus and abandoned the character of Hippolyta. In the opera, Theseus is known simply as the Duke, and his role is greatly reduced. The author of The Fairy Queen was far more interested in the play's other personages. A 17th century tradition of the English theater demanded that the principal roles of a production should never be accompanied by music. Another tradition insisted that incidental music could be used in the theater,